Timothy Good has conducted worldwide research on the UFO phenomenon, including interviewing key witnesses and discussing the subject with astronauts, military and intelligence specialists, pilots, politicians, scientists. He has lectured at universities, schools, and at many organizations, and has even been invited for discussions at the Pentagon. That was in 1998. And at the headquarters of the French Air Force in the year 2002. He has acted as a consultant for several U.S. congressional investigations as well. He has done superb research. I'm now reading one of his books called Unearthly Disclosure. Timothy Good, our special guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Timothy, how are you these days?
I'm fine, sir. Thank you very much indeed.
Always a pleasure. You know, when you started your interest in ufology, that came a long time ago, wasn't it? Was there a catalyst that really got you interested?
Absolutely. This goes back to 1955. I've always been absolutely mad about aircraft and space travel. When I was 10 years old, I was subscribing to sort of professional quality aviation magazines and everything, so I was fascinated by anything to do with aviation. And then in 1955, as I say, a cousin in America, Edmund C. Berkeley, who may be of interest to some listeners because he, I believe, started the first magazine on computers in the United States. One of its names was Computers and Automation. Well, Edmund gave me this book, knowing of my passion for aviation and space travel. He gave me a book called The Flying Saucers Are Real by Major Donald Kehoe.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest is history. I was immediately hooked because here were all these highly qualified observers, such as military and civilian pilots, air traffic controllers, and so forth, reporting encounters with unknown aerial objects. And I just couldn't see how these people would dare to risk their reputations unless they really had had an unusual experience.
You know, the same thing happened to me, Timothy. That book I read as well really got me interested in UFOs. I had read another one on just life in the universe by Walter Sullivan called We Are Not Alone.
Yeah.
And that got me hooked as well. And it's funny, as youngsters, how impressionable that we became when we read things like that.
Absolutely.
Now, as you, I guess, grew up into this field, how did you begin investigating these various cases and issues? Because you have been one of the world's deepest investigators.
Right. Well, of course, I was at school when I first became interested. And in 1961, I was a student at the Royal Academy of Music, and I continued my reading matter with this extraordinary book by Captain Ed Ruppelt, who headed Project Blue Book, the U.S. Air Force's Project Blue Book, called The Report on Unidentified Flying Objects. And again, that was a revelation to me. And I still think that the first edition of that book is and should be a revelation to anybody who has any interest in this subject.
Timothy, the book that I'm looking at, and I've been reading this since I received it, Unearthly Disclosure, is truly fascinating. But I've got to tell you, I have never seen pictures in a book such as yours. And, of course, the one series of pictures that just completely baffle me, and I wanted to talk with you about it as we get into this discussion tonight, is this picture that apparently was taken by an Italian of what could very well be a very small alien figure, right?
Absolutely, yes. Now, no one is saying this is an alien creature, but it is an unidentified creature. It was spotted first in May of 1993 by a painter and a ceramics artisan, Filiberto Capponi, on the slopes of Monte Vittore. That's Vittore Mountain in the Abruzzi region of Italy. And he came across this creature. It emitted piercing cries. It was in a crouching position at first, and then it ran off in a strange oscillating side-to-side motion at high speed. It had phenomenal powers of jumping. At some stage, the bandages came off, later that night, and they retrieved, Filiberto and his father retrieved the bandages.
Now, what do you mean by bandages?
Bandages were covering the creature's legs, and this was, as I say, they were hoping to have these bandages examined, but the next morning they'd hidden them somewhere, and they had disappeared, unfortunately. But later on, the creature kept reappearing on many occasions, right up till October of 1993, and it wasn't long after the first encounter when Filiberto managed to get two shots of the creature crouching on the ground. Those two first Polaroid color shots did not come out well. Overnight, they transformed. Very, very strange. I've handled the originals. They formed a sort of bas-relief, the raised portion where the actual image was. So you cannot see anything clearly. But later, over the ensuing weeks and months, he got very clear close-up pictures of this being, as you can see from the photographs.
It looks like this creature, whatever it might be, may have gone through some kind of burning or fire or something.
That was the impression that the witness had. Another similar creature was seen around June, floating in the air in a controlled manner by a retired Italian Air Force pilot. There were other sightings as well. It's a most extraordinary story that the pictures were finally confiscated, and Filiberto was served with a search and seizure warrant. The pictures were confiscated from him, and he was charged with disturbing the peace, the public peace, and he was forced to sign a confession saying that he fabricated the photographs. Well, for the sake of the peace and his family and the small village community in which he lived, he agreed to sign a form saying that he'd faked the pictures, but he refused to sign the rest of it saying he'd faked the whole story. And eventually, the pictures were returned to him. It's an extraordinary story. At one stage, an embassy car in Rome, a United States embassy car, chased the entire family in their car through the streets, and it was quite evident that they were trying to get hold of the original Polaroid pictures.
Incredible. And it also looks like whatever this burned creature was wearing, it looks like it's some kind of a suit, because you can see some tubes coming out of it.
I don't think it's a suit, George. I don't know what it is, but there are tubes apparently coming out from the sternum, the breast area of this creature.
Do you think that's natural?
I don't know. It's only been observed in one other case, as far as I know, and it's a case that Filiberto could not have known about, and that's a case from Puerto Rico. It's very, very rare indeed. I don't know what the purpose of those tubes was, but at any rate, there are other weird marks on the skin, if one can call it that, other things to look for. I did, in fact, hire a forensic expert. I commissioned him to do a serious study of the photographs, the images. He's worked a lot for the police, studying video works and photographs for court cases. Mm-hmm. And he concluded that it wasn't possible to say what the creature was or where it came from. But he did not conclude that it was a fabricated model. There's always a fly in the ointment, George, in every good case. The fly in the ointment with the Filiberto Capponi case, that's his full name, is that he is an artisan. He works with clay materials.
Okay.
He's a very good painter and everything. And of course, immediately people say, well, he just fabricated the model. But I've examined his photographs, and the guy I commissioned to do the work has examined them as well. And he's convinced that it's not a fabricated model.
I wonder
model.
If it's one of those chupacabras, Timothy. You never know.
It does appear different, I would say, quite different from the chupacabras. We just don't know what it was. There were a few odd UFO sightings in the area at the time, but nothing really to link it definitely with anything from elsewhere. But it does seem to be somebody's creature.
Absolutely. A couple different areas we would like to talk with you about tonight, Timothy. First of all, pilot sightings, and then really the incredible story about the possibility of subterranean and submarine alien bases on this planet. Mm-hmm. And in your book, of course, when we get to it, you talk about three states, for example, in the United States that have alien bases, and we'll talk about that. But I've always been fascinated by pilots who may have seen unidentified flying objects. In you've done a pretty good case history of this. How widespread is this phenomenon?
Well, according to Dick Haynes, Richard Haynes is a former NASA physicist. He's done a great deal of work on the pilot cases, pilot encounters, particularly in relation to aviation safety. And he estimated that there had been about 3,400 reports by military and civilian pilots. Of course, there's many that we don't get to hear about, so I think you can probably safely double that number by now at any rate. And he says it's been going on since 1920, and there have been cases, there were cases throughout World War II. You know, there's this myth perpetuated by the media that flying saucers started with pilot Kenneth Arnold in June of 1947. Over Washington
State.
That's not true at all. There were numerous reports. We're all familiar with the Foo Fighters, but there are other reports during World War II. The British government, in the last few years, has released some hitherto secret documents, Royal Air Force intelligence reports on sightings by bomber crews, not just of these small, spherical, remotely controlled probes, but sometimes quite large unknown aircraft flying at phenomenal speeds. And in one case, in 1942, an actual object seen on the ground and then taking off by the crew of a Lancaster bomber. And it's been going on ever since then. And there have been some very disturbing encounters. And that is one reason, one of many reasons, for what I'm convinced is a cover-up. And it's a perfectly justifiable reason, because many planes and pilots have disappeared in connection with UFOs.
Now, do you think the craft has gobbled them up, these planes?
Actually, in some cases, literally, that appears to be the case. I've spent a lot of time in Puerto Rico. I've been there seven times, and I've spoken to witnesses in two different locations who have seen F-14 Tomcat U.S. Navy fighters actually apparently swallowed aboard a gigantic triangular-shaped craft in Puerto Rico. And there's all sorts of rumors that the craft were later returned and so on and so forth. But undoubtedly, very, very strange things have happened. A good friend of mine, who was a British Airways pilot for many, many years, was flying in a private aircraft in Puerto Rico in 1993. I've described this case in Unearthly Disclosure. When he was actually flying from the capital, San Juan, to Mayaguez on the west coast via the Arecibo radio telescope. And shortly after flying over and filming the Arecibo radio telescope, he suddenly found himself within a split second on the south coast, 25 nautical miles away. This experience was so shocking to him that he couldn't even comprehend it at the time. It took him not months, but several years to realize what must have happened to him. He was literally transported with no apparent notion of speed or space or time or anything. He was suddenly somewhere else over a restricted area, which is, you know, can be punishable by fines and so forth. It's a CAA violation. And he had absolutely no explanation for it. And this has happened to other pilots. In his case, he was lucky, but there have been other pilots who have not returned.
I was going to say, have there been reports of our planes or other planes from other countries being shot down by UFOs?
There have been a number of cases reported worldwide in Above Top Secret and the successor, Beyond Top Secret. I've described cases from Japan to Puerto Rico, where aircraft when pursuing UFOs, have disappeared or have been destroyed in rare cases. There's one case which is supported with National Transportation Safety Boards, and that's from June of 1980, which I've got in Unearthly Disclosure. You can see the actual NTSB document there, wherein it describes how two young pilots flying an air coupe, light aircraft, from the Dominican Republic to Puerto Rico shortly before arriving on the west coast of Puerto Rico, reported that their course was being disrupted by an unidentified object, which kept causing them to change course. And then they sent out a mayday, and this was picked up by an Iberia Lines plane and rerouted. That was the last that was heard of them, and there was a lengthy air-sea rescue search, and they never found the aircraft or the bodies of the pilots.
Why the hostility, Timothy?
Well, some people might say it's not hostility. They're just grabbing a few people for various...
little testing?
Exactly, yes. I mean, that the whole abduction argument centers on that. You know, is this for their benefit or for ours? And we can perhaps get onto that later. I keep an open mind about it.
Maybe they're also looking at our craft to see how sophisticated we're getting. Maybe every once in a while they do want to monitor our own technology,
yes,
just to check out our own brain power.
Or they've got their own Smithsonian on.
Well, that's a possibility. or hopefully not a zoo of creatures from around,
yes,
the universe.
Yes. My feeling, actually, George, is that we are dealing with several species of beings from elsewhere, some of whom do not have our best interests at heart.
Could you imagine, and this is a frightening thought, but I just thought of it, just chatting with you here, Timothy. Maybe a zoo idea is not that far-fetched. What if you had an alien race that thought this was something that they should be doing for their own delight, but they had a zoo, and that they would visit other planets throughout the universe and collect earthly species like human beings, and maybe on another planet somewhere in another galaxy or system, yeah, they'd pick up occupants there or inhabitants, and they had them in their own zoo. And I mean, if you were on their planet, you'd go by the zoo, and in one particular cage it would say Earth, Milky Way Galaxy, or something like that.
Yes, I've seen a few nice science fiction programs about that, but there may be some truth in that, George. However, what I do think is that definitely there is evidence that they are collating samples of our species, of animals, humans, flora and fauna, everything. Maybe in the event of some catastrophe on this planet of ours, to preserve those species for implantation or hybridization or whatever elsewhere.
Or maybe to come back here later, maybe it's a Noah's Ark type thing.
Yes, exactly. That is another very, very interesting possibility.
Are you convinced, we're coming up to the break, but are you convinced that governments are aware of what's going on?
Some. Certainly, according to my information, elements of the United States government, and I have to call it a kind of cabal, if you like, because most people in the United States government, in the Congress, don't have the slightest clue what's going on, quite frankly. I can assure you of that.
Okay, so let's hold that thought, Timothy. When we come back, I want you to elaborate that on a little bit more, at how people in government might not know what's going on, but another branch of government might, or maybe that branch is so secret, maybe our legislators don't even know that that branch exists. We'll be back with Timothy Good in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Timothy Good as we talk about pilot sightings of UFOs, and we will get into also the subterranean and submarine alien bases. But Timothy, before the break, we were chatting about what governments may or may not know about this UFO situation.
Right. Well, Dr. Edgar Mitchell, who was the pilot of the Apollo 14 lunar module, mm-hmm, and the sixth man to walk on the moon, he's discussed the subject with a number of people in the military and intelligence community who convince him that the U.S. government has covered up the truth about UFOs for over 50 years. He says, I'm convinced there is a small body of valid UFO information and that there is a body of information 10 times as big that is total disinformation put out to confuse the whole issue. And I agree absolutely with that. And as he adds, he was talking to journalist Billy Cox of USA Today, in 1996. He says the dangerous part is they're still operating under a black budget, which has been estimated at over $30 billion a year. Those are, for example, special access programs, as they're known. And nobody knows what goes into black budgets. The prime requisite is security first and everything else second. Imagine an organization that has a black budget, an unquestioned source of funds, reports to no one, and has this exotic technology that they can keep to themselves and play with. And this is the crucial point, he says. The information is now held primarily by a body of semi- or quasi-private organizations that have kind of spun off from the military intelligence organizations of the past. Just like we build a rocket through a private contractor, there have been private groups involved with this issue for a number of years because they have the expertise.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's true. I think that's how it works. And there is a relatively small group, but it must involve several hundreds of people.
Do you believe, Timothy, that it goes as high as the presidents of the various countries?
No.
Or the leaders? Some of them don't even know what's going on, do they?
They don't, no. Now, there might be exceptions. George Bush Sr., whom I've tried to meet, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
I had a polite letter from his secretary not so long ago saying it was unfortunate. He appreciated the spirit and nature of my inquiry, but he was just too busy. George Bush, according to my information, George Bush Sr. has a great deal of information about this subject. Acquired partly when he was director of Central Intelligence,
right,
which includes
right.
CIA, of course, and the whole intelligence community. And I believe that he had a considerable amount of knowledge. The information I've received is that not all presidents are briefed on this subject, and even when they are briefed, they're not given everything. They're given what they need to know. Everything is on a need-to-know basis. A colleague of mine asked the present incumbent of the White House about the UFO situation, and I think it's twice now that George Bush Jr., President Bush, has said, ask Cheney. So there you have the answer.
He passed it on to him, huh?
Yeah. And needless to say, nothing has been forthcoming from either Cheney or President Bush, who is alleged to have promised that he would reveal information about UFOs when he got into the White House.
Well, and I understand that when Bill Clinton was president, one of his first acts was to assign someone to find the truth out about UFOs.
That's absolutely correct. He was frustrated in his endeavors. I don't know if he's since acquired more information, but I think it's understandable that not all presidents are told what's going on.
Apparently, the late Richard Nixon, when he was president, not only knew about UFOs and aliens, but had seen the bodies.
He had, and you know, Jackie Gleason, the great comedian and fine musician, by the way, he was taken by Nixon to Homestead Air Force Base.
In Florida.
I think, I don't know if he dumped him at the gate or whatever, but at any rate, Gleason came home white as a sheet and told his wife, Beverly McKittrick at that time, that he'd actually seen the bodies on ice or whatever, and it had deeply shocked him. That was thanks to his friend Nixon.
That would be jarring, I think, for anyone.
Yes.
To see. I mean, I think I could accept it, Timothy. I think it would fascinate me. But I think what would then really begin to overwhelm me, even me, would be after you see the physical beings and you just get an idea and you look at them, then you start to think of the ramifications, the fact that they have visited here and that they're out there and that there may be many like that throughout the universe. That's when it starts to get you.
Yeah, I agree. And there's just so much information that's being withheld. You know, Roswell was conveniently debunked during the 50th anniversary, if you realize, in various subtle ways by the Air Force and the CIA, various reports, which were full of fundamental errors throughout. And you know, ignoring vital evidence from important military witnesses. We know from you know, affidavits signed, for example, by Brigadier General Dubose, who was Chief of Staff to Major General Roger Ramey at Fort Worth at the time of the Roswell incident, he's confirmed that, you know, they just they got hold of an old balloon, ran it up 200 feet and crashed it and showed it at the press conference. And he has confirmed that a containment strategy, in other words, a cover-up, was ordered by General Clements McMullen, who was Deputy Commander of Strategic Air Command. And the reasons for the cover-up were perfectly understandable and justifiable at that time. And this is what they said. You know, we'd just gone through a world war. We'd seen the firebombing of great cities, atomic bombs, destruction on an unprecedented scale. Then came this flying saucer business. It was just too much for the public to have to deal with, and I agree.
I would too, I guess, but maybe it's time for disclosure now. You know, just a few days ago, I had a report of a alien woman. She's a former rancher. She's very old. Her name is Jean Cole, Timothy, and she lives in Roswell, New Mexico, in that area, Albuquerque, actually. And she said, I don't care about the government anymore. I'm not afraid. And she said that she witnessed the crash of some kind of an object. Mm-hmm. And she heard it. She heard it as she went. She went and went and crashed. She did not say it was a flying saucer. She didn't know what it was. But it definitely was not a balloon.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and if our government is saying that, then something's wrong.
Yes, absolutely.
What about other reports of anybody witnessing crashed vehicles? I've always been perplexed, Timothy, at how these sophisticated craft could get here and then crash. Why?
Yes. Yeah, it seems kind of clumsy, but, you know, there are always unprecedented situations, and there are rumors, for example, that our new experiments with high-powered radar interrupted their delicate navigation or control systems or whatever. Quite honestly, I don't know the answer to that, but it seems clear that crashes have reduced over the years. They've learned from their mistakes. But I'm very compelled by a story. I find it very convincing. From August 1945, New Mexico, apparently there was a crash in San Antonio, not to be confused with Texas, San Antonio, New Mexico, in August of 1945.
2 years before Roswell.
Two years before Roswell, and a few weeks after the first atomic bomb was exploded, not that far away. And I've spoken to one of the witnesses. There are actually four witnesses. The elder ones are now deceased. But the two witnesses who first encountered this story, one is Remigio, or Remy, as he likes to be called, Remy Barker, who was seven at the time, and his buddy Jose Padilla, who was nine. And it was on Padilla's ranch in August of 1945, that they saw a brilliant light accompanied by a crunching sound, seemingly from a nearby canyon. They were on horseback at the time, and they headed towards the area. There was smoke, a great gouge in the earth as long as a football field, and an oval, semicircular object with a sort of bump on top could be seen. The heat from the wreckage, there was lots of wreckage. They found the heat from the wreckage and burning grease were very, very intense, so they retreated. They headed back, worrying about casualties. There was some similar material to that which was found at Roswell, very shiny material, which they managed to recover one piece of. It's a long story. I don't know how much time we've got.
Go ahead.
They did actually
give us the highlights.
Did see strange-looking creatures moving around very, very quickly. They seemed like us, they said, like children, not dangerous. They were quite scared, and they went back, and they told the owner of the ranch, Jose Padilla, and 2 days later, Jose's father came out with a policeman, and they all went out toward the crash site, and they couldn't see it at first, but then they found the craft was there. It had been covered by dirt and debris, and it looked like a lot of the materials from the craft had been collected. So apparently the military had got there, but the main body of the craft remained in place. And then on the 20th of August, an army sergeant turned up and said that the army had lost a balloon. They needed to take down most of the gate to the main entrance to the ranch so that a trailer could pick it up. And later, Remy and Jose actually watched from a secluded position as the military recovered the craft and put it on a flatbed truck. And there were, it was guarded most of the time, but not all the time. And the boys managed to actually get to the tall boy where the truck had been put under a tarpaulin. And Jose, the elder one, got on board and managed to yank off a piece of material, which he still has, and I've handled that piece. I went out to the West Coast in June, and I met Remy. I've actually seen that material.
What does it look like to you?
Well, now, here's the fly in the ointment, George. As I say, all the best cases have a fly in the ointment. It seems, that's the important word, because I don't know, it seems to me to be very terrestrial in appearance. It's like some kind of bracket. It's got provision for screws or fittings of some type. It's about 11 inches long. It has been analyzed very thoroughly. A lot of attention has been paid to various types of analysis on the aluminum. And there really doesn't appear to be anything that would indicate that it necessarily that it comes from anywhere else other than Earth.
But it could.
This does not stop. These people are, I find them convincing witnesses. I haven't spoken to Jose Padilla yet, but I've certainly spent quite a bit of time with Remy and his wife and a good friend of theirs who's helped them with the scientific investigations. And they don't change the story, you know. You'd think that they'd sort of draw back, you know, once it was shown to be apparently not from Earth. But this is not unique. There have been other cases where weird stuff has been found, and it's found to contain mostly elements that are found here on Earth.
Don't you write a report of a biophysicist who apparently has some alien materials or had?
Absolutely. I'm glad you raised that. This is a Polish biophysicist who's given the pseudonym Dr. Chris. I write about him beyond Top Secret that in 1974 he was on contract to NASA with a member of a small but international team, including French, English, and Italian scientists. They were given odd metallic and plastic-like materials, sort of unusual Kapton or Kevlar-type material. They examined foamed metal, memory metal, like that was found at Roswell, whose melting point, the melting point of which was above 2,000 degrees centigrade. And then some years later, 1977, at JPL, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, in Pasadena, California, they were taken, some of these scientists from the same team were taken down into a vault in the building, and they were shown two plexiglass containers. With one had the hip bone of an apparently alien creature and a third of a skull of an apparently alien creature. Since, you know, these guys, at least Dr. Chris was a biophysicist, he said it was not a monkey or an elderly child or anything, that the skull material was thinner than humans. And they also recognized in this vault previous samples that they had seen before, which they'd been told had come from an Iron Curtain country. Now, interestingly, Dr. Chris learned that there had been at least two incidents in New Mexico, because those samples were labeled from the first and second incidents in New Mexico.
So that could have been 45 and 47.
It could have been. They asked about that. They said, "I'm sorry, that's well above top secret. We're not into names and dates, places and dates." But interestingly, they learnt quite a bit about these creatures. So there had been apparently one survivor from one of these crashes. Now, I'm sure you've heard all the rumors about that, and I believe it. I've got other sources who've confirmed it. And this biophysicist said that their blood was similar but not the same, in that it showed a totally different reaction toward oxygen. Hmm. Nitrogen was no good for them, so inside their ship, they surmised, they must breathe a mixture of helium and oxygen. So I think that's a very interesting case. There's so much evidence.
Any idea how long that survived alien may have lasted?
I've heard things like to the 50s. There are some people who try to tell you that they're still alive and spouting information and giving us secrets of the universe.
Well, why didn't his... let's assume that's true for a moment, and I've heard that too, but why didn't his own come back and get him, or even now?
Well, perhaps after the break we can talk about the revelations that have been provided for me via a very high-ranking Pentagon source, in which it is alleged, it could be disinformation, but a lot of it's true, I'm sure, it is alleged that there was a threat by the aliens to have some of their craft and bodies returned to them, and they gave a very dramatic demonstration of their ability to control the weather in a certain area in New Mexico, and our authorities complied with their request, apparently. It's all outrageous stuff, George, but it's an outrageous subject.
Well, and you know, you just said something that was interesting, too, possibly disinformation. Mm-hmm. Do you think they've come at you, government officials, under the auspice of Tim, we're your friend, Timothy, and we're going to give you some info, but they're trying to mislead you?
In some cases, yes. Definitely. In other cases, no. There's an old saying, you know, those who don't know talk. Those who know don't talk. Those in the know generally just simply do not talk about the subject.
All right, well, stay with us when we come right back at the top of the hour. Timothy Good, our guest, with a book. It's one of the best I've read on the subject, Unearthly Disclosure. Also, next hour, we will get into the subterranean and the submarine alien bases. I'm telling you, what a series of stories you are going to hear. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Code. Right before the break at the top of the hour, Timothy, you were going to tell us about some revelations given to you by a Pentagon source.
Via a Pentagon source. Absolutely, yes. Well, back in 1995, I was introduced to a senior reporter in Washington, D.C., who's provided me over a period of years with a great deal of information, which he, in turn, obtained from a senior U.S. Air Force officer. Now, my source, whom I call John in Unearthly Disclosure, is a U.S. Army intelligence veteran, and a highly respected author, magazine editor, and correspondent, and he specializes in aerospace journalism. And I found him compelling, I must say. He's very skeptical about a lot of what he was told, which was in the late 1980s. He's protected the identity of his source, incorporating some false details about his background, but what seems certain is that this Pentagon guy worked in the U.S. Air Force Air Staff and the Joint Staff. The information is truly sensational, if it's true, but according to the Pentagon officer, aliens have been coming to Earth for a very long time. Following the Second World War, they began to establish permanent bases here on this planet in Australia, the Caribbean, the Pacific Ocean, the Soviet Union, and in the United States. And specific areas are given in the United States, which we can go into later, but I just want to get a sort of overview of it.
Okay.
By that time, the officer explained that a number of alien craft had crashed and had been recovered, together with bodies. Initially, these were taken to Wright-Patterson, Dayton, and then later to Homestead Air Force Base in Florida, which is interesting in view of what we were discussing earlier about Jackie Gleason and President Nixon.
That's a good point.
But, of course, somebody could, you know, just provide that information just to sort of please those who've heard that story. So one has to always to be careful. But apparently two creatures who had survived a crash. So they're talking about survivors here. This is outrageous stuff. All crashes were killed by an Air Force policeman outside Kirtland Air Force Base in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And this provoked a phenomenal response by the deceased creature's colleagues, who allegedly demonstrated how they could control the local weather. Communications were thus established, and the aliens insisted on the return of the two corpses and contact with the U.S. military, represented by an Air Force major, initially was initiated in the late 1940s, apparently. Now, we've seen these rumors before, but
yes.
I'm just reporting what has been said in a very serious manner over a period of years to this guy via this Pentagon, high-ranking Pentagon officer. It's interesting, we talked earlier about the sort of hidden government, if you like, and I mentioned that hundreds of people must be in the know. Well, I was told that by the late 1980s, at least 100 OSI, that's the Office of Special Investigations, Air Force Office of Special Investigations personnel, had knowledge in varying degrees about the alien presence. Now, OSI includes, its main duties are counterintelligence, criminal investigations, sometimes including deception, which is referred to euphemistically as special plans. And of course, OSI has a long history of involvement in UFO investigations. And in fact, in 1998, when I was in May of 1998, I was invited to the Pentagon to discuss the subject with the Defense Airborne Reconnaissance Office. I was invited by General Kenneth Israel, who was then the director. And after the meeting, he sort of implied that if any organization was currently involved in UFO investigation, it most likely would be OSI. So that's interesting.
Now, when you talked about they wanted to demonstrate something, I guess, to show their power with changing weather. What did they do exactly, Timothy?
I don't know. I haven't been given any specific information about that.
Okay.
But I know of another person, a Brazilian scientist, Rubens Vilela, who's a meteorologist. He's a former CIA communications officer. He's been on, I think, 12 expeditions to the Antarctic, mostly with the United States Navy. He had a UFO sighting in Antarctica. He established communications with ETs, apparently. And he was very, very skeptical. And because he's a meteorologist, he asked these guys, the ETs, to demonstrate, to prove themselves, their powers, by changing the weather. And they did that in front of him by all sorts of extraordinary things with the clouds in a local specific area.
In every region of this planet, the former Soviet Union, now Russia, China, the Japanese take this seriously, Mexico, Brazil, it's all over the planet where they're getting significant UFO reports. And in some of these countries, as you all know, Timothy, the scientists there take this pretty darn seriously, don't they?
They do. In fact, let me talk about China briefly. You can't become an official UFO researcher in China unless you have a degree and published peer-reviewed papers on your specific discipline. It's taken very seriously indeed. And the Beijing UFO Research Society, for example, meetings are regularly attended by Air Force and Communist Party officials. Most researchers, and there are thousands and thousands of them in China, are scientists and engineers. The whole attitude in that country is quite different, and in fact, it's been commented on by one of their spokesmen who said that American scientists envy us for our freedom, our academic freedom in discussing the subject without fear of ridicule. Whereas the majority of scientists in the United States daren't speak up because of the curtain of ridicule. So that's one. And China and Russia's another. They're not quite so open as the Soviet Union.
A department dedicated to UFO research when it was the former Soviet Union?
Absolutely. I mixed things around there. The Soviet Union's not quite as open as China, but it goes back to 1947. Stalin became very interested in the Roswell incident and ordered an official investigation through his scientific advisors, and they came back and said that, yes, something had apparently happened. It wasn't an American device. And that's when investigations began. And then there was an official acknowledgement of UFO reality on Moscow television in 1967 by a retired general and by Professor Felix Siegel of the Moscow Aviation Institute. They said, these things are real. We need reports from Soviet citizens. This is a serious challenge to science. And, of course, they were absolutely inundated with cases from all over. And in 1977, President Andropov, longtime chief of the KGB, ordered 4 million soldiers to file detailed reports on any UFO sightings they might encounter.
4 million soldiers?
Yes, were involved. And I also heard this from a general, that this was a unique 10-year UFO research effort, which also involved the Ministry of Defense, the Russian Ministry of Defense, and the Soviet Academy of Sciences. And then, of course, Presidents Reagan and Gorbachev have discussed the subject initially at the Geneva summit, and they agreed, it sounds mad, but this is a fact, they agreed to join forces in the event of an alien threat. And as you know, or may know, that Gorbachev has actually confirmed this at a speech at the Kremlin in 1987, talking about that Geneva conference 2 years earlier. He said the U.S. president said that if the Earth faced an invasion by extraterrestrials, the United States and the Soviet Union would join forces to repel such an invasion.
I know. And I find that to be just a great statement. I know the late president's son, Michael Reagan, and we talked for a couple hours about UFOs and
really?
What his father saw. I think the impression was his father was a believer.
Absolutely. It was 1974 when Reagan, when he was governor of California, ordered his pilot to chase a UFO, and there was a Wall Street journalist either on board, I forget which, or at the landing, but he talked happily to him about his interest in the subject, that he and his wife were involved in the UFOs since that subject, and at another incident before that, I believe.
I find it fascinating that two countries that had possessed great technology, Germany with its rocketry, ahead of us at the time during World War II, and then eventually us, both had reported cases of UFO crashes. I'm wondering if the Germans' rocket technology, Timothy, during World War II might have been based on the fact that they had retrieved UFOs. I'm also wondering if and I'd love to say it's because of science brain power here in the United States, but I'm also wondering if the retrieval of crashed saucers here also contributed to our burst in technology so far ahead of some of these other countries.
I think if you're talking about Operation Paperclip, where Nazi scientists were taken over to the States and to Russia. The Soviet Union, by the way, grabbed quite a few to develop their program, which was very, very slow. It was years before they could get any copies of V-2 rockets flying. But, of course, as we all know, the Americans worked very, very swiftly, immediately following World War II. I don't think it explains this, really. In some ways, possibly, but when you look at the extraordinary technology exhibited by these craft from the very early days, in the early stages of World War II, reports by pilots, these things were defying any kind of technology that we had at that time. So I don't think it's really a satisfactory explanation.
What about in the United States when we were told that some U.S. companies were given parts from the crashed saucers
Absolutely.
And reversed engineering?
That's from Lieutenant Colonel
Philip Corso, right?
who headed the Army's Foreign Technology Division and under Trudeau, I believe, was given this extraordinary
Trudeau,
material.
Under Trudeau, I think.
Yep. Yes. I believe that story. It's not exactly as it's described in the book. Now, Corso did not have time to adequately review the manuscript prior to publication, I'm told. It was co-authored with William Burns. And I understand that the way the material was distributed was not quite as described. They actually waited for some of these firms to begin, who'd sort of got inspired ideas about certain technology at that point, then they passed on the information and said they got it from the Iron Curtain or whatever and asked them to sort of see what they could do with it.
I think one of the tragedies, too, is the fact that Corso has passed. I've talked to Bill Burns. I know Bill real well. And it's who knows, had he lived, what other things he might have been able to reveal.
Yes. Well, apparently there is quite a bit that hasn't come out yet, but that's up to his son.
Exactly. Of everything you've researched, and we're going to get into the subterranean field in just a moment, but of everything you've researched in this field, is there one thing that still startles you, baffles you, Timothy?
Oh, I don't know where to start. it's such a multidisciplinary, vast subject. In order to really understand what's going on, one needs to understand so many aspects of it, and it's not possible. There are scientific aspects, there are intelligence aspects, military aspects, religious, spiritual aspects, psychological. I mean, one could go on forever and a day. I'm baffled by, I suppose, exactly, I don't know exactly what's going on. I'm aware that there's more than one species involved, that the situation is never static. Various races may come and go. I think that this planet is important because it's unique in our solar system, maybe for light years around. Most of the people who've had contact or have been abducted have been told that this planet is unique in many respects.
Because we have so much different kinds of life, maybe?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. And I think some of them have got their BDI on this planet. So there's a possibility that some of them may have a vested interest here. I'm absolutely sure of that. And that's what I learned through my Washington source.
That's not a good thing.
No. But there are others coming here who are perhaps millions of years ahead of us on a spiritual level. And that's something else we can perhaps discuss. And this leads, of course, to religious ramifications. These religious ramifications have been brought up even in a military report by retired French generals, police officers, and so forth, called the Cometa Group. And they published this report in 1999, an extraordinary document.
Well, what do you mean by religious implications? I think I know where you're going, but I want to hear it from you.
Well, from my point of view, you know, could it be that we were seeded here, or at least we were interfered with genetically? I think it's most likely that at some point in our history we've had visitations, and that there has been interbreeding. I'm absolutely convinced of that.
Well, 100%. I am too. But I also think that is another reason why one has the ability to believe in God, because eventually someone had to create them.
Right, and you know, from the standpoint of the Christians, I mean, supposing it could be shown that Christ actually came from somewhere else, and that Gabriel, the angel Gabriel, was his father, and that he was seeded within Mary. You've got all the things. You've got Jesus' extraordinary abilities to levitate, walk on water, telepathy, apparently healing gifts. You have the resurrection, which I believe the Catholic Church regards as a bodily, physical event, with the two men in shining raiment standing beside him, going up in the air. You have the extraordinary appearance when Saul's conversion, Paul, Damascus, when this brilliant light appeared in the sky, and the soldiers were fearful and all that. All of it, I think, is very intriguing, and it does tend to point towards another worldly origin, and maybe other religious leaders too.
Based on your research, do we know where these beings may be coming from specifically?
I think they tend to be guarded about their origins. It's very easy if they come from like another galaxy. That's no problem, because we're not going to get there for a very long time. But if some of them, for example, have bases or way stations or what within our solar system, including our planet, they're not going to be forthcoming in giving specific locations, I don't think, for obvious reasons. But so we have to take their statements regarding origin with a pinch of salt sometime. I mean, one of my most convincing contact cases, a lady I write about in Alien Base, she said there was just one thing that was several things that were a no-no. They don't talk about their propulsion system in any specific detail. They don't discuss their origin in any specific detail.
All right, well, stay with us, Timothy. When we come back, let's get into the underground bases now, something that we've been leading up to, because I'd like to get your take on why they have them. Why not just come down from a mothership? Why do we need bases? And what are they doing also in the ocean? Apparently, there are submarine bases, and we're not talking about Navy submarines. No, no, no. We're talking about the bases underwater of alien craft. There have been all kinds of reports on craft taking off, lights underneath the ocean. We'll talk with Timothy Good about that as well when we come right back. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. And Lex has some great information, by the way, posted right under Timothy Good's name on the coasttocoastam.com website. Timothy, as we get into these underground bases, the book, Unearthly Disclosure, is it on the bookstores now? How do you get this?
Well, it's one of the few books of mine which hasn't been published in the States, unfortunately, but it is widely available in paperback form. I've seen it in most of the Borders shops in the States on my many trips, so it should be accessible there.
Can you get it through Amazon.com?
Yes, you can. In fact, there's a direct link to that via my website.
Excellent. I mean, you've really done a thorough job on this one. I mean, you're good, but they keep getting better and better and better.
Well, thank you very much. Others might not agree, but I'm glad to hear it from you. Thank you.
Underground bases, under ocean bases. Tell me a little bit about why they are where they are.
Well, as to the whys, I don't know. I can tell you where, certainly, and how. The bases were said by my source to be constructed by the aliens using their craft as boring machines, allegedly, and this is wild, with some assistance from the military. My source said the aliens were capable of excavating to astounding depths, apparently. And as far as some of these bases are concerned, supposedly the United States Army was charged with guarding a number of the bases, and the guards would not necessarily know what they were guarding. And that's interesting because there's an early case from 1949 at Fort Hood Army base when some guards were not told what they were guarding, but they saw lights, very strange lights, entering and leaving a certain part of the ground on this very huge base. So that's interesting. The bases, apparently worldwide, are vacated at periodic intervals, usually after no more than 6 months.
Like they use them and then they leave?
Then they later return and reactivate them.
Huh.
Specific locations in the United States were given, allegedly Alaska, New Mexico, at Manzano Mountains, the close to Kirtland Air Force Base, specifically the Manzano weapons storage area, nuclear weapons, that is. So, you know, it's known that there have been many intrusions by unknown aerial craft in that specific location. I've seen that location. I was taken there by a colonel who was in charge of security there, who was very interested in the subject.
And apparently we have these subterranean bases in three of the states in the United States.
West Virginia, allegedly one located in the Monongahela National Forest in Pocahontas County, which is about 8 statute miles northeast of Durbin, West Virginia. And unfortunately, my source drove around the area with another researcher, and he couldn't find everything appeared exactly as his source had described it, but they could find evidence of nothing. Neither did another investigator who I commissioned to explore the area in 1998. He interviewed many local residents, including a police officer, none of whom could recall any unusual activity. However, you know, this information is 20 years old. Who knows?
And you talk about deactivated, maybe they're not coming back there anymore.
Who knows? Who knows, George? I mean, as Stanton Friedman says, absence of evidence isn't necessarily evidence of absence. So,
true.
The other areas, too, they were very concerned. The military was very concerned about some of the undersea bases. So there were specifically two ones. The location wasn't given, but they were said to be the largest of the bases on our planet.
Now, there was one in Alaska, right?
Alaska, that's correct. Yes.
Okay.
No specifics are given there.
Now, these underwater bases,
yep.
When you talk into, I mean, are they just UFOs that just sit on the bottom of the ocean, or are we talking about structures?
We're talking about huge structures. There's one contactee who I've written about in Unearthly Disclosure. Enrique Castillo, who first had encounters in 1963 in Costa Rica and made contact with aliens, had many encounters. I find them compelling. They're full of contradictions, but I find them very interesting. He was allegedly taken to two alien bases, one of which was located in the Mariana Trench in the Pacific Ocean, which I think it's about 11,500 meters deep at that point. I think it's the deepest trench on this planet. But the base was located in the trench wall, about 5,000 meters below the surface. And he was told it was constructed conjointly with another ET race very, very many years ago. And there were huge dome-like structures and extraordinary things.
It's like the movie The Abyss. I don't know if you ever saw that movie.
I did indeed.
That kind of reminds me of that.
What was of grave concern to the officials was that regarding the Pacific Ocean, the aliens posed a threat to the environment, the military believed, because they were, quote, messing around with tectonic plates, unquote. Also, John told me, my source, he said that the presence of the alien ships in our oceans was causing, or at least contributing to, the warming of the waters. He didn't say why exactly. Now, supposedly, the aliens have been requested by those few in the military who had had access to them to vacate their undersea bases. The request was ignored. Now, doesn't that open an interesting can of worms?
Well, it sure does. It sure did. Now, we've had also reports from boaters, people who've been on ships. They have seen lights in the ocean, underwater, just kind of streaming along, right?
Yes, goes back hundreds of years. There are reliable reports in ships' log entries, many reports by naval personnel throughout the world and civil mariners who've seen undersea glowing objects. Sometimes these can be explained as illuminated plankton or whatever, luminescent, I think it's plankton. I'm not sure. There's other types of life on the ocean surface which can be luminous. But other things, that distinctly solid objects have been seen not only coming out of the sea but coming out of the ice. There's a Russian naval intelligence report on Soviet Navy craft, which I've described in Beyond Top Secret. And this huge craft just came straight through the ice, showering the ship with chunks of ice. So these things are very solid. They've been reported all over the place. And I find it fascinating. And we tend to ignore the USOs, the unidentified submarine or submergible objects, as I call them.
Do you think some of the submarine cases where we've had tragedies, I remember the Thresher a long time ago, the Russians have had problems. Do you think it's possible that UFOs underwater have also played havoc with those?
Well, I keep an open mind on that, George. I don't dismiss the possibility. I tend to think that in most cases, just shoddy maintenance and various other reasons contributed towards those awful disasters.
We have some very high-level sound detection devices. Do you think we have ever used that to find these underground, I'll call them cities?
I'm quite sure that there are all sorts of above top secret naval intelligence surveys to detect interesting things going on within our oceans. You've got that extraordinary case, the Shag Harbour incident.
Tell me about that.
Which Don Ledger has written a complete book about. I think it's called Dark Object, if my memory serves, by Don Ledger, and I recommend it. It's about an object which was seen to crash in the harbour in Canada, and I can't remember the exact location, you know, without sort of piling through billions of files and things and getting the book out, but it is a very important book. Don Ledger is a first-class investigator, and it appeared that this thing had moved quite a long way under the ocean and ended up near some top-secret naval facility, so it's almost certain that the Navy must have tracked it. But a lot of information is being withheld on that.
A Dark Object is the name of that book.
I believe so.
Yep.
And in fact, there's a documentary which we get over here many times on Sci-Fi Channel and Discovery Science. I think it's it's called something like the New Roswell, something like that. I'm not sure. It has different titles in different countries, but it is shown fairly regularly.
And that was near Halifax, Nova Scotia.
Correct. Thank you very much, George.
We have an excellent research department here, Timothy. They're at our fingertips.
Yes. Thanks for your help.
What about sailors? Let's talk a little bit more about this. I mean, this is eerie when you think of it. You're on a ship. Let's say it's nighttime. All you can see, the moon and maybe some stars. And then flying out of the ocean at tremendous speeds is some UFO with lights and everything. I mean, that's got to be daunting for people.
There have been many, many sightings. It is daunting. Don't forget that two-thirds of our planet, at least, is water. And just, you know, being alone on the ocean, if people are, you know, sailing across Atlantic or whatever, as sometimes they do, and you have an encounter with that, it must be very, very frightening indeed. And, you know, whole crews of ships have seen these things at very close quarters. There have been sightings over aircraft carriers by Mr. Grzynski, as I recall his name, quite a well-known case in the 1950s aboard an aircraft carrier when many personnel saw this thing come down quite low. Was seen by many of the...
And it just plunges personnel into the ocean?
It didn't in this case, no. This was actually seen above the craft, above the naval ship. It wasn't above the aircraft carrier. It wasn't seen going into the ocean.
What's your reaction to the Russians who have apparently found something in Tunguska in Siberia? You've heard about this?
Well, I have a very good source in Russia, Nikolai Lebedev, who's a journalist, an engineer, and he's helped me a great deal with my research. He says, take this seriously. There's been a lot of debunking, but he treats it seriously so far at any rate, so stay tuned.
Yeah, I'm thinking, well, maybe it's some fallen Soviet satellite from way gone back, but who knows?
Well, not in 1908 or 109.
But I mean, maybe it's something that fell in the 60s.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that should easily be determined.
Yes. Exactly.
Yep.
Have there been any reports, and I'm not talking about the Bermuda Triangle now, where ships have just merely disappeared?
Well, there have. Actually, there's an area in the Great Lakes where, according to National Transportation Safety Board statisticians, there have been more strange incidents in this area than the Bermuda Triangle, and particularly the western end of Lake Erie. There's a book on it. Again, I can't remember the title of it now, but it's really a first-class book. If I have a chance during the break, I'll go into my library and get it. But there have been many disturbing disappearances of aircraft, in some cases in full view of aircraft flying nearby. Planes apparently forced out of control, disappearances from the final approach fix to landing have been noted. People just watching a plane on its final approach suddenly disappear. That's in both Great Lakes and in the Bermuda area. Very, very strange, and many ships sometimes have remained invisible, or they're seen on radar, and vice versa. Very, very interesting indeed.
The subterranean bases, the underwater bases, done apparently, as you said, with help of some of our military.
Certainly not the undersea ones, but
no,
the underground ones. I don't know to what extent. I mean, I'm very skeptical about that, but I can believe that some of our military might be used to guarding something. They might not necessarily know what they're guarding. And it's interesting that one of these alleged bases was said to be in the Manzano nuclear weapons storage area. Now, I mean, you know, how useful to bury one secret within a very sensitive area. I think that's quite interesting.
Has anybody ever reported, I don't know, that they were able to see occupants? I mean, do they have close encounters anymore?
Are you talking about the guys in the military?
Yeah.
Well, according to my source, the Air Force officer himself claim to have seen craft and met two of the beings at or near, and I rather believe it's near Pine Gap in Australia, the famous Pine Gap.
Like a handshake meeting?
Well, whatever, yes. I have not been given any details, George, but apparently there are other military guys who've been introduced, or whatever, to some of these guys, and they couldn't handle it. One of them was sent to the Walter Reed Hospital and was psychologically very, very seriously.
He broke down after this?
Yes. Not my source's source, but another military guy. So that's interesting. Also, apparently, there's been a technology transfer. You've heard a lot about that. This has been confirmed. They have been sharing some of their technology, but just why they were doing so was not made clear.
And I'm sure they don't give us all their technology, right?
They do not. What I was told was we'll have to rewrite our physics textbooks. We had already advanced in areas of research that touched on their own technological expertise, such as the use of the torus that's used to contain plasma in nuclear fusion reactors.
Hmm.
Plasma physics is the key, the officer declared. The aliens are highly advanced in the physics of light, well beyond our laser technology. And I like this. Apparently, we make good pupils and have adapted well to this new technology.
They enjoy teaching us, huh?
Again, George, this information goes back, you know, nearly 20 years now. Interestingly, the aliens are capable of dealing mentally with any local intruders on their territory.
Are they using this system as propulsion?
What I was told was that they use a form of electromagnetic propulsion, taking advantage of the Earth's magnetic field. They were capable of faster-than-light speeds, presumably for interplanetary travel, I suppose. But I think, is quite interesting. There have been others who have been told that electromagnetics is sort of involved in some type of propulsion system which generates its own gravitational field.
They must have been able to bend space-time somehow.
Absolutely. I have no information on that other than from other contactee sources, people who claim to have been taken on board, like Enrique Castillo, like Leo Dworshak, who I hope we might be able to speak about, a gentleman I met a couple of months ago in Montana, who claims to have had, together with his brother, encounters with aliens dating back to 1932.
All right, let's talk about Leo when we come back, and we'll also, you up for some phone calls?
Sure.
Got one more hour to go with Timothy Good. Let's open up the phone lines as well. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment at Coast to Coast. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Timothy, let's talk about that case before we go to the calls of Leo. Was it Dworshak, you said?
Dworshak, yes. Dworshak. Leo Dworshak. Now, he's written an extraordinary book called UFOs Are With Us. I'm going to give the address now, because you know how it is, one might forget.
I understand.
You can write to him direct, get a signed copy, send $12, including postage, to Leo Dworshak. The address is 3000 Villard Drive, that's V for Victor, Villard Drive, number 204, 3000 Villard Drive, 204, Helena, Montana, 59601. And you send him $12, and he'll send you a signed copy. And I find this a most compelling case. Immediately I read it. It read like something that was true. Now, I went to interview him over a period of 2 days in June in Helena. And
so he lives in Montana?
He lives in Helena, Montana.
Okay.
Yes, he does. But these encounters, together with his brother, they're German-American farm boys in North Dakota, and in 1932, they encountered a landed craft. At some distance, they gradually got a little bit closer. They watched it. They came. Days would go by. It wouldn't be there. Another week, maybe. Then they would see it again. And eventually, they got very, very close. They could see the occupants, but always preventing them from getting any closer was an invisible shield, like like glass, but you couldn't actually see anything at all.
Like a force field or something.
Exactly, like a force field. They noticed the rabbits and birds colliding with these things, and they would be stunned, and they couldn't explain it because there was nothing visible. But eventually, that force field was reduced, and the boys were allowed to meet the occupants. Initially, they were described as human, 5 to 6 feet tall, very good looking, completely telepathic. They knew not only what you knew, but they could somehow anticipate your questions ahead of time. And it was an extraordinary experience. The book provides a wealth of scientific and technical data, as well as information about these beings. And
how old are they now?
Leo is, I think, 83, 84.
Oh, my God. Okay.
He's doing very well. He's had a very distinguished military career in the Navy. His brother, alas, his brother Mike, was killed in the Korean War, the start of the Korean War in 1950.
Oh, okay.
But they both had these experiences, and they lasted quite some time, and eventually they were allowed on board the craft and shown some absolutely incredible things. I've never read, it's one of the most compelling contact stories I've ever read, and it's so detailed, really quite incredible, and I hope you get him on your program sometime. The same applies to Rimi Bakker and Jose Padilla on the West Coast.
You'd be a good resource for us, Timothy, if maybe we can do it jointly where you and they are on.
I'd love that.
Okay, and I'll just let you work and arrange it with Lisa and just set it up.
Okay.
I'd like to do that. Good. When did Leo write his book, if he's in his 80s?
Last year. It was published last year.
82 years old at the time, then, and he writes his book.
Yes. Well, he's been writing it for, you know, for quite a few years.
Now, what are some of the things they reveal to him?
Oh, my goodness me, that they were apparently very interested in what we were doing to our planet. There was a sort of feeling that they were very concerned about the environment. I know we've heard this before in cases, but this is 1932. They were very concerned. They were studying the grasshoppers, for example.
The grasshoppers?
Grasshoppers, yes, because there was a plague of grasshoppers at that time in North Dakota, and the officials were trying to get rid of them, spraying them with something, not DDT, something similar.
It must have fascinated them.
They were very concerned about the environment, and they implied that human beings were spread throughout the cosmos. They apparently came from another galaxy. Their method of travel was virtually instantaneous. There's so much detail.
And they look like us, you said.
Very similar. Very similar. And very similar among themselves as well. This is an interesting thing. There weren't any great varieties in their facial features or other physical features. They made it quite clear that that our world was in great trouble. Many more problems were to come. Interestingly, that when they were taken on board the craft, they were disinfected with some kind of mist. We've heard of this before, like Antonio Villas Boas. There was that case from Brazil in 1957,
killing off whatever germs they might have had on themselves.
Right.
Huh?
Yes. We study the life patterns, they said, and they visit this planet on a regular basis. They apparently have 12 of them permanently here, living on this planet. Supposedly, they have the most phenomenal technology. They can project real-time scenes. They can make their craft apparently invisible. They can reflect the sky. They can do whatever they like. They can stop a bird in flight and hold it motionless in midair, apparently. They could stop any moving object at any range they desired. And
just stop it.
He said our military men should take note. They could reverse the trajectory or path of a moving object at any time and could return anything that was thrown at them, including shells or bullets or whatever. So I think that's interesting.
That's amazing technology.
Yeah. Yes, and these contacts went on for many years, for Leo in any case, right up to the 1960s and beyond.
And now they're gone? No more?
Well, he feels that he's occasionally in some kind of telepathic contact with them. We can talk about that with him sometime.
Okay. You work it out with Lisa, and let's get him on.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, let's go to the phones. Let's go west of the Rockies. Welcome to Coast, you're on with us. Hi there.
Hello, George.
Yes.
Fantastic program tonight. Hello, Mr. Good.
Good evening, sir.
I wanted to share with you something that happened in September of 1975. I was stationed aboard the USS aircraft carrier, the USS Forrestal, based out of Norfolk, Virginia.
Uh-huh.
And we were given a briefing, all departments on the ship. We set sail on September 1st, and we were told that we were going to undergo a shockwave test in conjunction with NASA scientists. We steamed out for the area off the coast of Fort Lauderdale, which is commonly known as the areas of the Triangle. And we were approximately 80 miles off the coast of Florida. The NASA experts had wired the entire ship for this shockwave test, and we were told that they were going to explode four main charges off the bow, the front of the ship, and they were approximately 60 to 100 yards away from the ship. I was standing a generator watch that night, about 1 hour before we went into battle stations, general quarters, and I was standing a generator watch for the main diesel generators that supply power to the ship. At the moment of the impact of the test, the entire ship literally shook. There were steam pipes that broke. There were areas of water pipes that broke. And I was standing a generator watch with headphones in constant contact with central control on the bridge. I was given a call from an officer in central control asking for me to give a report on what had happened to the main generators. Apparently, the entire ship had gone into battery backup systems. All of the power had been drained off of the main generators, and there was no explanation. I told them that I was standing right in front of the generators. They were running full force. The oil pressure was good. The bearings weren't hot. They sent a master-at-arms security man down to the boiler room, down to the diesel room, and to verify my story. Once he got there, he arrived with three other NASA officials, and I was ordered to go back to general control and give my report of what had happened. Well, once I went up there and gave my full report of there was nothing wrong with the generators, but something was draining the power, I was ordered to go back to my post. Well, I had been ordered with a partner of mine who was standing a watch, and we decided to go up to the flight deck because we were burning up from the heat down in the boiler rooms.
Now, that's the same ship where 120 men had died in 1967, right?
Yes, that training film on the USS Forrestal is the one that they still show in boot camp to explain how to fight fires.
Right.
That's the footage that came off of the USS Forrestal.
Yeah, that I'm told that's a haunted ship as well, but that's another story.
Yeah, lots of stories. But yeah. What I wanted to say was, instead of going back to the engine room, we went up to the flight deck because we knew how to get there through special tunnels and catwalks because we were engineers. We went up there to cool off, and while we were up there on the catwalk, below one deck below the flight deck, we both saw four craft underneath the water. Two of them were cylindrical, and three of them were kind of a triangle shape with red, blue, green, and white lights. We were astounded at this. The moon was lit that night, and we could see the water around the entire area of the ship was like a clear glass lake, like on a beautiful Sunday morning. We knew that this was impossible for water out in the ocean to be without motion. Well, because we weren't supposed to be there, we were supposed to be back at our post, we weren't allowed to share this with anyone. And yet later on, when we got back to Fort Lauderdale, we shared this with other people on the flight deck who saw the same things that we did. An entire area about a mile in circumference of pure, smooth, like glass water. And we knew that these craft that went by were not submarines because we had seen submarines before at night. Submarines have a single tower with lights on them. And we were just never able to talk about this, but we always found it very, very strange that NASA was the one that conducted this experiment.
That's interesting all by itself, Timothy, isn't it?
Absolutely. Before I forget, please, would you give your contact details to the staff at Coast to Coast. I would very much like to discuss that further with you.
Yeah. Well, one thing that always bothered us was none of this, no details of this account ever appeared in the media in Florida or in any of the naval media there at Naval Operation Base there in Norfolk, Virginia.
Right.
Nothing ever appeared in the media. And we were told by the men that we talked with on the flight deck that they were threatened that if they ever revealed what happened that night, that they would be severely court-martialed. So,
were you debriefed?
No, I wasn't debriefed because, like I said, I wasn't supposed to be up on that area next to the flight deck. I was supposed to be back at my post.
Okay.
We went up there to cool off because we were so hot from the heat in the engine room. Mm-hmm. So if I had told my officers that I was up on that area, I would have been in serious trouble. Because during battle stations, you are supposed to be exactly where you're stationed. I'm sure George knows that. He was in the Navy.
All right, that's true. Not in a battleship, but I was in the Navy. Sure was. All right, we're going to put him on hold. We're going to get his email address and send it to you, Timothy, okay?
Thank you very much indeed. I value that. I very much value hearing that story, let me tell you.
All right, let's go to our first-time caller line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Yes, I'm Joseph.
Hi, Joseph. Where are you calling from?
Watsonville, California.
Welcome, Joseph. Go ahead.
Thank you. I'm enjoying your program, Timothy and George. I have two basic questions. The first one is I have heard the possibility of the saucers being human beings from the future and time traveling. And the second question is about some science fiction books I read a long time ago called The Shaver Mysteries, in which they describe an underworld with an electric sun and flying saucers that come in and go out from an opening in the earth. You know anything about either of those?
Yes, yes, I do. Certainly The Shaver Mysteries is intriguing. There were a lot of stories published in the 40s about all that and the 50s. Whether it actually applies to our subject, I don't know, quite frankly. Now, just remind me the other case. I'm sorry, because I was making a note to ask you something. Your first question.
The idea that flying saucers are
from
human
our future.
Beings from the future.
Well, this is encouraging because, you know, it presupposes we've got a future. So I find that a very encouraging viewpoint. Actually, I do believe time travel is possible. What I'm not convinced about is that beings from the future can actually participate in the past. Mm-hmm. I think it's possible to observe the future and the past, but the degree of participation I find somewhat dubious. But time travel, yes, I believe in, but I do not believe that these beings are necessarily from our future. I wanted to ask you, sir,
yes.
There's a very interesting gentleman who used to live in Watsonville called Sid Patrick. I just wanted to know if you know him.
I'm sorry, I haven't met him that I
know
of.
Well, in my book, Above Top Secret, I write about his contact back in 1965 near Watsonville when he was taken on board a craft. He was a U.S. Air Force reserve pilot and a very, you know, highly respected engineer. He's still around that area, I believe, but he's very much stays in the background now. He doesn't like to discuss his experiences, but they are written up in both Above Top Secret and Beyond Top Secret, a wonderful, wonderful contact story, which I find compelling.
Interesting. Well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you for calling.
I'd like to leave you with this thought, and that is of the idea of omniscience and determinism. Thank
okay.
you.
All right, thank you. Appreciate it. Let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast. You're on the air with Timothy Good. Hi.
Hello, how are you doing?
We're well, thanks.
Hi, George. I'm the Planet X guy. But anyways, I was going to ask your guest, do you think you have ever seen or talked to an alien? Because it seems you desire to see an alien, like many people wish they could see an unknown God. Also,
the answer is yes.
The what?
The answer is yes. I have had an encounter. In fact, I've had two encounters, both in the United States. The first was in 1963 when I was working with the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra, and it was stopping at a diner between, I think, Tucson and Los Angeles. It's a long trip, and they very kindly let us have a half-hour rest stop. And I saw an extraordinary-looking woman waiting in line, and she appeared very similar to descriptions by the notorious George Adamski, whose many claims I have studied, and I find some of them compelling. She appeared very similar to his description, and I had learned even then, back in 1963, that these guys and girls were very telepathic. So I posed the thought, I put the thought, are you from another planet? There was no immediate response, but as she came out of the line, she went past my table, first with a deadpan expression on her face, then she did a very, very demonstrative bow in front of me, and then her face changed again.
So you've done it three times?
She walked away. Sorry?
Two times.
Three times?
Two times.
The second time was in New York in 1967, in the middle of New York City. I think it was at the 6th or 7th Avenue, up by Carnegie Hall. I was doing a series of concerts with the London Symphony Orchestra, and I was really desperate to get some evidence. And I sent out the thought, if any of you guys are in the New York area, please come and sit down next to me. And of course, you've got to be careful in New York and hotel lobbies and so forth. Various peculiar people came and went. But eventually this guy comes down. He's straight out of Madison Avenue, immaculately dressed, tanned. If you're going to ask me any country of origin, I would have said Scandinavian. So there you are. There's a Nordic for you. He was about 5'10". He came down and sat next to me. I asked him in my mind, are you from another planet? If so, take your right index finger and hold it to the right side of your nose. No sooner had I thought that than he stuck his right index finger to the right side of his nose and held it there. Now, of course, what do you do after that? You know, I thought he was going to tell me the secrets of the universe. There was absolutely no conversation whatever. Being English and quite relatively young at the time, I thought, well, you know, we English, we don't talk to people unless we've been introduced. So it's so I just sat there like a lemon and nothing more happened. And yet it was cathartic. It changed my life.
All right. Stay with us. We'll be back with more of your phone calls with our special guest tonight, Timothy Good. Welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie and your phone calls with Timothy Good. Timothy, in 1989, Admiral Bobby Ray Inman was chatted. He's former director of the National Security Agency. Tell me a little bit about that story in your book.
Well, I wrote about this in Alien Contact, as it's called in the States, Alien Liaison over here. This was a conversation, a recorded conversation, during which Admiral Bobby Ray Inman, as you say, former director of the National Security Agency and deputy director of CIA, former director of Naval Intelligence as well, was asked by investigator Bob Exler during a recorded phone conversation on behalf of Admiral Lord Hill Norton and myself. You know that Lord Hill Norton, former Chief of Defense Staff, is one of my, or was, he passed away sadly recently, was one of my great supporters, and he did the forewords to many books. And Inman was asked, do you anticipate that any of the recovered vehicles would ever become available for technological research outside of the military circles? Now, that's meaning E.T., the words E.T., UFO, were not used in the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
But although he denies it, Inman knew perfectly well what the conversation was about. He replied, I honestly don't know. 10 years ago, the answer would have been no. Whether as time has evolved, they are beginning to become more open on it, there's a possibility. Inman then referred Exler to Rear Admiral Sumner Shapiro, former director of Naval Intelligence, as well as the then Deputy Director for Science and Technology at CIA, Everett Heinemann, for further information. Now, unfortunately, many of Bob Exler's claims have subsequently been shown to be false, in my opinion, based on my investigations. But that is a recording which cannot be
disputed.
Denied.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, back to more calls. Let's go to our wildcard line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hi, George. This is Kurt calling from Two Arbors, Minnesota.
Hi, Kurt.
Listening on 710 WDSM.
Sure thing. Good to have you with us.
Say, I had a question for Mr. Good here.
Mm-hmm.
I was kind of curious, have you ever given any consideration to the Great Pyramids with the evidence of advanced technologies discovered that it could have been the precursor to Area 51?
Well, I wouldn't know about Area 51 specifically, but I'm not a specialist. I'm not a pyramidologist, if that's the right word. But I am aware, of course, of the extraordinary attributes that the pyramids do have. And I think it's quite feasible that there may well have been contact with the people at that time.
What do you think of, and thanks for your call.
Thanks, George.
What do you think of Eric von Däniken's works?
Well, I think he's made some egregious exaggerations and assumptions, but we all owe it to him for the fact his books were bestsellers, and they just raised in the public awareness the possibility that we may have been visited in that past, and we owe him a gratitude for that much.
At least he opened up the eyes. Huh?
Exactly. Since then, we've had great scholars like Zechariah Sitchin, you know, who is really gone into certain aspects of ancient astronauts in a very scientific way.
East of the Rockies, your turn. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hi, George.
Yes, sir.
This is Jeff calling from Midland, Texas.
Hi, Jeff.
550 KCRS.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to say also hi to Timothy Good.
Hello.
Yes, sir. I have read your book, Above Top Secrets.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay. I had a comment and then a question for you.
We're ready for you. Can you hear us?
Okay.
All right? Okay.
Yeah, I'm doing good. I'm on a cell phone, so it's a little
lag there. Go ahead.
Yeah, a little lag. One thing I want to mention really quickly. You remember the story about the lady from Albuquerque who was coming forward?
Yes, the one we just had a couple days ago.
Right. I had just taken a trip up to Albuquerque in August, around August 2nd, to see Rod Stewart, one of Mr. Good's fellow countrymen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. Yes, sir. And we took a scenic route on the way back, and we went through Corona, New Mexico. And I would say, don't stop in Corona unless you have business there. It was very, it felt very strange.
Was it eerie there? Why?
It was eerie. There's really not too many people there. There are a lot of retirees and people like that.
Yeah.
I don't know what the main business source of income is in that place, but it just had a weird aura to the town. So I don't know.
Sure.
That just a thought. My question for Mr. Good.
Yep.
Yes. There was a British aircraft that was a submarine hunter aircraft, and I go to the air show pretty much every year here in Midland.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You familiar with that, sir?
You're talking about a Nimrod, right?
Okay.
Yeah,
what's your question, though, Jeffrey?
Okay, yes, sir, yes. This thing went down in one of the Great Lakes.
I saw the video of that.
And I was really disturbed by that because I really enjoyed seeing those guys perform, and then I read about it later in the paper. I was really just. I wonder what happened. What was the outcome on that?
Well,
listen off the air.
I don't know, quite honestly. Certainly it wasn't UFO-related. It was a horrible thing to witness. I've witnessed, like yourself, I'm an aviation buff, and I go to air shows, and I've seen my share of air crashes, and it's always horrible. But I don't think it was related to our subject, so, you know, regrettably, we don't really have time to go into
speculation
about something not related to the immediate
discussion. I think that was all mechanically, mechanical problems there. West of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi. Hello.
Good morning, Timothy Good. How are you today?
Hi.
Good morning. I'm fine, thank you.
I'm a very close friend of Leo Dorchik, so I was glad to be able to catch you tonight.
Great.
I gave him a bunch of tapes, and you took them home with you. Are you familiar a little bit with
I haven't played them yet, so I can't comment. I'm sorry. I've got a whole stack of stuff here, but I do have them.
As soon as you can, please play them, because I have a program. I am a hybrid from...
Oh, really?
Yes. And there's a number of us scattered over the United States, and I feel that you are too, as well as Leo Dorchik.
Oh, news to me.
Okay, tell us a little.
Feeler that I've been in all my life, and I'm coming up 70 years old.
Hold on, tell us a little bit about why you believe you're a hybrid.
Well, I was told so by Azetti, who is also a hybrid. Do you take the UFO magazine, Timothy?
I do.
Okay, you look. I believe it's on page. I think it's page 28. There's an advertisement for a book, Stranded on Earth. Very true book, and I mentioned in it.
What do you look like?
I look like any other human. I grew up here at Pendleton since 1936, and I'm a little taller than the average, and I have met with two survivors of the Roswell crash.
Well, now let me ask you two questions then. They're kind of fascinating here, Timothy. First of all, if you're a hybrid and you look like us, what's the purpose of making a hybrid? I mean, so what's a little...
We were seeded. There's about 200 or more, maybe more, that were seeded here on Earth back in the 20s and 30s for the end times. Because the end times is 2012.
And what...
Hal brought that out a few weeks back on a program.
And what happens... in the end times.
If a meteor hit Earth between now and then, unless we have a change in the attitude of all the people on Earth and stop all the wars and
heal the Earth, then
Earth will be hit with a big meteor.
But what are we going to do with the hybrids? What happens?
The hybrids are like myself. We're out here trying to open the door and tell the truth, just like Leo Dworchik is and myself.
So you're like messengers.
That's right.
Huh. Any questions for him, Timothy, or do we move on?
I don't have any, no.
Okay, well, thanks very much. Appreciate that. First time caller line, you're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hey, how you doing, George?
We are well. Where are you calling from?
I'm in my tractor trailer southbound on Interstate 81
what?
In Virginia.
Drive carefully, and what's your question?
Well, I have a question and a statement. I drive across through West Virginia quite a bit up on that stretch of road that he was talking about up through Durbin. And a couple nights going up through there, this has been recently, that I saw some low-flying helicopters. Now, 10 miles south of Durbin is a place called Greenbank, West Virginia, where the National Radio Telescope is.
Right.
And I'm wondering if there's any correlation or anything. Does this all mix together right there?
Well, I'm glad you raised that, because I it's very interesting that there's the guy in the Pentagon said that there was a base in the Caribbean. I'm sure that base is Puerto Rico, actually, that area. Interestingly, of course, we have the Arecibo Radio Telescope there, which performs very similar functions to the National Radio Astronomy Observatory at Greenbank. So who knows?
Let's go to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Good morning. This is Drew listening on WAI.
Hi, Drew. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. Well, the question I have for your guest is, I guess speaking like the other gentleman did, let's say that everybody were to come forward and the shroud of secrecy were to fall on this subject, what would it do to, let's say, Christians or Hindus or Muslims or even atheists? Would there be a mass panic or just, you know, his take on it, if he's ever heard anything on his circles, and I'll hang up and listen.
All right, I assume you mean if there was an admission that we've been visited?
Yes, sir.
Okay, what would happen, do you believe, Timothy, to modern-day religion or religions in general if governments came forward and said, we've been visited?
Well, I think some people would welcome it, but others would fear it, and I think certain religious authorities would be very disturbed by it, particularly if it's mentioned that we might be related to some of these beings. But it's very interesting. There was a poll conducted in Detroit in 1971. People asked, you know, how would you react if beings landed on Earth? And one person said, "I'd welcome them. They couldn't be any stranger than what's walking around Detroit."
Hey, I was there when they took the poll, by the way.
Really?
Yeah, seriously.
And the other one I love is, I teach them to stay on their own planet. We've got enough people on welfare without supporting a bunch of Martians.
East of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Yes, hello. This is Keith in Ontario, Canada.
Hi, Keith. Go ahead.
Hello. This infamous Roswell story, in a sense, I don't believe it very much. Mr. Friedman years back said it could be 99% proven, and, you know, through all these paranormal shows and, you know, through your show, you know, I've heard hundreds of people who have been there, their grandparents, their second dog. You know, I say, where's the proof? This is an internet world. There's no photos of the crash records strewn around miles and miles of acreage. There's nothing but speculation and hearsay. And
well,
I can't believe
proof,
nobody
yeah.
had a camera back then to take, you know, a photo.
I take your point, sir, but the military took the photographs. They took all the wreckage. They took the bodies, and they're not about to discuss it.
But it has
been definitely withheld at what amounts to an above-top-secret level. We're dealing with the most sensitive subject in the intelligence community.
It was cordoned off very quickly, wasn't it, Timothy, by the military?
Yes. And they combed that area. I'm just hoping that Sci-Fi Channel people will eventually actually obtain some real materials there for analysis in that area.
I think one of the compelling stories of Roswell also was the Undertaker,
yes.
who talked about being asked to build three small coffins.
Absolutely. And the nurse, his friend, the nurse, who was actually present at an autopsy.
Is she still alive, do you know?
No, not as far as I know. He did give a name out, and he's been criticized for that. He was told he would never give that name. In fact, he gave out a false name just to see, just to check that somebody's integrity, and of course they immediately came out with it. He will never, ever give out the real name. He made that promise, so we don't know the name of that nurse.
All right, the clock's ticking. Wildcard line, it's your turn. Hi there.
Hi, George.
Yeah.
Hi, how are you doing tonight?
I'm fine, thanks.
And Timothy, I have to ask you this. You had a previous caller that you wanted to contact who was in the Navy who said he witnessed UFOs under the water.
Yes.
I couldn't help but be reminded of a show that I saw like 5 years on the Discovery or the Learning Channel that parallels that so much, and you mentioned it briefly, about Shag Harbor.
Yes.
In that show, I saw where they actually send divers down and saw them through these portals. They actually saw the aliens through there, and I want to know if you knew more about that.
Did they actually see aliens? I didn't think they actually said specifically what they saw, but they were disturbed by it.
Yes, on the show they stated that they saw them.
Okay.
And I was hoping that, like you just mentioned, that maybe Brian Gumbel, who's been doing those investigative reports for sci-fi, like he did on Rendlesham Forest and Pennsylvania, when that they would look into the Shag Harbor one, because supposedly that was eyewitnesses who came forward in the Navy that, you know, were afraid of breaking the secrecy code and all that, but they had done so.
You mean to develop on the documentary that's already
correct, the one that I saw, 5 years ago.
Okay, I'll mention it if you like.
And what was that book called that you said was about it? Dark what?
Dark
Waters?
Dark Object, I believe it's called.
Yeah, Dark Object.
By John Ledger.
Okay.
It's about the 1967 crash, right?
I think that's one of the most fascinating stories that I've ever heard.
Yes.
And I wish it would get more publicity.
Well, it's getting, well, it is getting a lot of publicity on the documentary. Certainly over here, we see it regularly.
Do you? Okay.
Yep.
Very good. A lot of people want the address for Leo again, his book. Do you want to give that
out? Good. Yes, please. Yes. It's 3000 Villard, V for Victor, V-I-L-L-A-R-D, Drive, 3000 Villard Drive, number 204, Helena, Montana, 59601.
59601.
Correct. That's the zip.
Excellent. And you're going to work on getting Leo on the program, huh?
Yes.
All right. Let's go back to our West of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George.
Yes, sir.
Hey, Mr. Good.
Hello.
So you've read Leo Dorschach's book.
I have. Very
Not only has he read the book, he's talked to Leo.
Right. He's my grandfather.
You're kidding.
Oh, great.
No. I've been trying to contact you for like the last 6 to 8 months.
Okay.
Because he wanted to get George a book.
Yeah.
I'll take it.
Yeah, I've sent emails and stuff to try to get a hold of you to get a book.
I'll tell you what, I'm going to put you on hold and get the address from Rob, okay?
You bet.
Okay, here we go. Rob, why don't you give him our mailing address here, and we'll get that right out there. That's a pretty compelling case, I would assume, Timothy, is it not?
Absolutely.
Leo's case?
For me, yes.
Excellent. Your website, timothygood.co.uk.
That's right.
Number of books out there, and the most recent, available on Amazon.com. Timothy, where's this all going to go? Are we ever going to get government disclosure?
Short answer, I don't know, George. There are various problems that those few in the military and intelligence community who know about this have to deal with. One thing I learned is that there is a conflict of interest in that some of these species are there's hostility between some of them. And as it was put to me, we don't want to get in the middle of that. That's a problem. Some of them coming here are friendly, others not friendly at all, and that is a problem. How much do we disclose? But what I'd like to say is that, you know, whatever threat is posed by alien species, I am firmly convinced we have a great deal more to fear from our own beings.
Well, you're probably right about that, Timothy Good, no doubt. And we're going to post, by the way, Leo's address under the recap of tonight's program on the coasttocoastam.com website. Timothy, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you,
George.
That's
Timothy Good. He does a lot of good work in the field of ufology. For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesour, Barbara Simpson, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie.